I'm Con Pinholt, and I'm the president of LLH. I'm elected, so I'm elected leader of the board, but at the same time, I have I'm the executive director of the secretariat here. So we have, so I have a double role. The organization is a national organization. We have 14 local branches, and we are and we do everything. We do social work. We do make it just creating meeting places for LGBT all over the country. That's some of our, that's the basics somehow. Meeting places in all sorts of ways, from choirs to parties to sporting activities, all that sort of things, and most of that is completely voluntary basis. But at the same time, we do political advocacy for LGBT rights, both nationally and internationally, and we do some legal counseling for individuals who are in need. We do we have different projects, especially one that I like to talk about, which we've been talking to the project leader of, Rosa Kompetanse, who's working with health workers. Mm-hmm. So we have a wide, too wide range of activities, I would almost say.
Could you briefly tell me the history of the organization?
Yes, it's one of the oldest LGBT organizations, I think, worldwide. It was founded as a Norwegian branch of the Danish DNF 1948. In Denmark, they started a small organization in 1949, and I think 48, it must have been 48, and then our Norwegian branch of that started up in 1950. And we've developed since then into what you see today, an organization with 8 employees and national or local branches in almost every part of the country.
Its earliest stages in the 50s, what was the kind of work that was being done here?
Well, I'm maybe not even the best person to ask, because I wasn't there. But much of it was social. But we had one activist, and I don't know when she entered the public as a public person, but we had one person who managed to be a public person at a very early stage, and at that time the political fight was to decriminalize homosexuality.
Is this organization a product of the founding of the gay and lesbian movement, or is it a different entity that works parallel?
No, we are the gay and lesbian movement, the organized part of the gay and lesbian movement in Norway, and we spring out of that, and we don't do much else either. So. Now we've added the trans issue only recently, only within the last few, 3-4 years, and only the last year properly.
So what is the foundational ideology of the organization, if you will?
That we are equal to everyone else and should have equal rights in every aspect of our lives.
Can you define that notion of equality as you understand it from within here?
Well, we've so far up to 1st of January, in the middle of last year, when it was agreed that we should have full marriage rights. It's been much a legal question to have equal rights in the laws. I think today that we are able to, we've put much of that legal fight behind us because those rights are there. So now we see that to have not just a legal equality, but also a real equality in our everyday lives, that the fight is elsewhere. And our main tool in that fight is to increase awareness and the competence on LGBT issues, of course in the general population, but also with people who work with people professionally. That's everything from health workers, people work in schools and education, people who are leaders and managements in and therefore have a relationship with how people do at work. Pretty much every aspect of society, there are people who work with people, and most often in Norwegian society they would like to treat us equally, but often when they try to do that, they do it with a lack of competence on how to, which means they often just ignore us and ignore the fact that we sometimes need some special considerations to be properly treated as equals.
Can you give an example of a situation in which there should be some kind of proper treatment?
We have many examples. Let's take the let's take an example from the school where a 15-year-old boy knows he falls in love with other boys, and throughout his school time he is introduced to all sorts of concepts of society, of marriage, of feelings, of course of sexuality, but also all the things around that, how families form, how the economy of families work, but he's never introduced to the fact that those families could be a gay family. In that way, his identity is not present in his in what he is taught at school. So he is, by that, beside society. He is someone else, something that we do not talk about. And many teachers want to do something about that, and want to teach about homosexuality, and what do? They take it aside and say, okay, yeah, we take a theme on that, and we invite LLH or someone else to talk about it or something like that. But and then a typical example is that they group it let's talk about abortion and suicide rates and how to avoid STDs and homosexuality. So it's grouped with one of the other problems of sexuality and love and that sort of thing, as opposed to having it as an integral part of when you talk about love, feelings, forming a family, because forming a family is always a man and a woman having kids. And so we're trying to push that, make people in general see that they have to see the real world and not just these ideas they have of the real world.
Is the LLH a government organization?
No.
But it's a government-sponsored organization?
Yes, certainly, which is very normal in Norway. That we are an interest organization, an advocacy organization. But we are, to a large extent, funded by the government. The government does not give us very clear indications on what to do with that money. But we do get most of our funding from the government.
So in other words, the programs that are produced and implemented here reflect the position of the government in regards to these issues of sexual orientation and gender identity, or that's not
It the fact that we do get money reflects that we have a government who realizes that we're a minority that needs special attention and also need to have a functional organization to speak our rights. But that doesn't mean that they put that they tell us what to think or what programs to implement. We apply for funding for particular projects that we want to do, and sometimes we get funding, sometimes we don't. So it's a bit of a mixture. I'm quite sure that if we had a very conservative government suddenly, that we could risk our funding. We probably could, and that's not a good situation to be in. But we do not feel that our organization is pushed in any way as to what to do by the government. If we use the project Bosa Kompetanse, working towards health workers, doctors, nurses, psychologists, psychiatrists, all sorts of people who work on people's health. Our project have been to develop tools to make sure that they have to educate them and give them a better competence on LGBT issues. Mm-hmm. That's been our job. We have advocated that project meets a constant demand for knowledge and competence on this issue that should not be met by us. That yeah, ought to be met by the government. So we have advocated that there ought to be a government agency doing that sort of work, because that is too big a job in Norway to just leave to a small organization like us. So far, the government hasn't been listening to that, and we're actually worried that we might not have funding next year or the year after that. We're all constant in worry that we won't have funding for what we see as important and completely necessary work.
Could you talk about the relationship between the achievements in terms of legislation in this country, which seem to be really far ahead compared to other countries, and the actual reality of the way people live their lives? I mean, I can marry, I can adopt kids and so on and so forth, but what is the kind of life that I would have out on the street, in school, working and so on and so forth?
I'm a firm believer in, and I also think we've seen that in Norway, that having the legal and the laws make us equal is a strong and important signal for the rest of the world out there, the rest of the Norwegian society. Without that as a backing, all the other negative things that we experience out in our real world, in our real lives, has a legitimacy from the fact that we're not equal in the law. Now when we're equal in the law, it's very difficult for our opponents to say that I have the right to treat you badly. Now they have to find other ways to make their arguments, because since we are equal in the law, they see that the society at large, the lawmakers, recognize us as human beings with equal rights. That means that it's much more difficult out there to treat us badly. But that doesn't mean that we're not treated badly, and that public opinion is okay. But I think that there are sub-communities in the Norwegian community where it's definitely not okay to be gay. But once that is confronted, our opponents have a real difficult time.
But that's the kind of, as you say, the kind of the official framework.
Mm.
But at the same time, I imagine that within tight communities that are driven by the church or school environments and work environments, there is still a kind of hostile situation that is determining the way people handle their lives.
Absolutely.
Is that what you're trying to do with the creation of these programs, to tackle that?
Yes, that's exactly it. We see that there are still a lot of sub-communities in Norway, like the ones you mentioned, different conservative churches, both Christian and Muslim, with very bad opinions on LGBT, very bad attitudes, where people who come out of there being LGBT tell horrific stories. We know schools and the school ground in general is a very difficult place to be LGBT. There's a lot of bullying going on, and we know that many people hide who they are at work because they're afraid. And that, of course, does not change because we suddenly can marry. But it does, the minute someone has the guts to stand up on it in his workplace, or the minute someone has, a teacher has the competence and the knowledge to say, no, we're going to get an end to this in our school or in our classroom, then they're the ones with the backing from the law, as opposed to the other way around. So I see the connection to the law, but we have a lot of work to do still. And we have found that the best way to confront that is by knowledge and awareness and visibility. It's not aggressive argumentation or advocacy that'll help in the public opinion. It is increased knowledge and also visibility, having all the examples out there, the positive examples.
As a kind of official face to the gay and lesbian movement, what is your relationship to other forms of gay and lesbian expression that perhaps resist or are critical of what is called a homonormativity from as a kind of political ground? I'm speaking about academics that might be interested in queer studies, political organizations that are not necessarily interested in categories, and so on.
My agenda is to make sure that everyone who is LGBT can be that in exactly the way they want to be. That you have the right as a person to define who you are and live that life, and you should not be limited by others. That also means that as an LGBT movement, I can't tell other people how to be gay, that they are being gay in the wrong way. And I think that is something that the gay movement, in an attempt to be to find the gay identity, which is an important quest, but in that quest, you've been moving on so fast that you've lost a lot of people, which means that some feel that being on the back of a truck in a pride parade, wearing next to nothing, dancing to disco music, is a no-no way to be gay, because that is stigmatizing, or I don't know. Whereas others think that getting married and getting 2.3 kids, or whatever is the average, is a no-no way to be gay, because you're supposed to be part of the party gay culture. My objection is to both. I think that we should work towards it being possible to be gay exactly in the way you are gay, and recognize that there are gays in all sectors of Norwegian society, and that we are just as different from each other, except on that particular point, as everybody else. And there is no right or wrong way to be gay. There's only one thing that is wrong, and that is living a life you don't want to live.
Is this traditionally the agenda of this organization since its inception, or has it changed according to who is directing at the time, and how does it change with you?
I think with time it's been easier to put the agenda forward that I'm putting forward now, saying that the LGBT movement should be seen as a diverse or the LGBT population should be seen as a diverse population. The further you are from having equal rights, the more discriminated you are, the more there is a need to stick together and be the same and find your common things. Whereas now, when we're not in any way living in an oppressed society, but we feel pretty much free, most of us, it's easier to accept and acknowledge that there's differences between us. We're not so hurt by it. I think that many people who watch the gay pride parades and see something that frightens them, that many LGBT who sees the gay parade and see that that is frightening, I do not want to be associated with that because that is not me. I think that most people who feel that way are still a bit insecure about whether it's okay to be gay in their way. So that's why it's important for me to tell them that it's okay to be gay in your way, but it should also be okay to be gay in another way.
And your programs address this specifically? In other words, is there a kind of diversity acknowledgement workshop or something like this? I suppose, because what concerns me is that if there is an image that is put out there, which is that of equality based on the legal framework, which is fantastic, mm-hmm. but it also reproduces ideas of marriage between two people, mm-hmm. and it's strategically very successful politically, but then also it might exclude identities that do not fit those categories, which is very much what you're saying, that you're willing to accept all of them. But how do the programs both support the legal framework and at the same time allow for those more diverse sexualities to
come? I think there's been a misunderstanding in some parts of the LGBT movement on the marriage issue. And that is the fact, that is another of those we have to be all the same. LGBT is one group. And that it stems from that misunderstanding. And the misunderstanding is that we've been fighting to get married, all of us. Mm-hmm. We haven't. We've been fighting for the right to get married, mm-hmm. which means that some people can get married if they want to, and others have the right to choose not to. Even the people who did not want to get married, never wanted to have kids, they never had the choice before. Mm-hmm. Even those people have now been given something. They have given the choice. They have been given the choice, a choice they didn't have before. Before, it was just meant that they were supposed to be what they were. Stay not married, stay without children. Now they have a choice, and they can actively choose not to.
I have questions about minorities within minorities. Most importantly, the recent addition of the transgender letter T to your program. Mm-hmm. Because I also know that there are differences between the gay and lesbian political agenda and ideology with that of the transgender. That's the first one. And then the second one maybe is immigrant communities and people that are not Norwegian citizens legally. Mm-hmm. How do they work within your program?
Mm-hmm. We are definitely not where I want to be in including both of those two groups that you're talking about. Let's start with the T. It's been included in our documents 3-4 years ago without much real effect. But in the last year, we've managed to get a little funding to have a project on what we call gender diversity. And it's been hugely successful. We've managed to do an awful lot of things in a short time. And have included, we've started a network of T people, trans people of different sorts, because that's not a homogeneous group either. And we've only just put down an own committee, a trans committee, who is supposed to give us input on policy on these issues, people with insight and knowledge and competence on it, on their specific issues. And we are then slowly gaining knowledge in the rest of the organization on the trans issues that we use in our discussions. So we're on the right track, but we're definitely not there where it's 100% included. But we're working on it, and I think we are on the right track.
Why is this a late arrival to why is it only happening now? I mean, it's not like transgender people just appear.
No, I think it's because it's been even more stigmatized than LGB. So that there's not been a willingness to include the T from the organization and the LG lesbian gay community, because getting connected to an even more stigmatized group just feels like it makes your situation even worse. And so I think actually in Norway, I think the T can be added on now because without much opposition anymore, because we don't feel so stigmatized anymore as lesbians and gays. So now we have the capacity inside ourselves to take it on. And yes, it's too bad that an even more stigmatized group should not have been included from the start. But it's an attempt of an explanation, but I don't know if it's true.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And what about the issue of the immigrants?
Yeah. Luckily, we have a gigantic group of that is called Queer World. Gigantic because there are more than 200 people who are connected to Queer World, of ethnic minorities of different sorts, and they're a very varied bunch. Some are asylum seekers, etc., etc. They do a lot of good work. And we work closely with them. And we work closely with them, especially on policy issues. We get input from them on what should be our lobbying work on different policies. And right now our main issue is asylum seekers. And at the same time we do some international work. We do development aid projects out in the world, which also gives us input into that sort of work. We are obviously a way too white organization, not 100% inclusive. It helps that we have Queer World, but really they should not have to be an organization on the side of the main part of the organization. But I also think we're on the right track now. We have one non-white in our board, and I hope that will expand on the different positions, not just in the board but also out in the country after a while. So we're getting there, but it's never enough, really.
I wanted to ask you in particular about the specific problems that these immigrant communities face. One, in relationship to Norwegian society, and two, in relationship amongst themselves, in terms of their sexual orientation or gender identity.
The first part is something that we've discussed a fair bit lately. How do we make sure that we include double discriminated groups and ethnic minorities, an important such group? How do we make sure that being a mainstream Norwegian organization, how do we make sure that we do not have the same mechanisms that would then exclude cultural minorities and religious minorities? How can we how can we make sure that we are truly an inclusive organization, which we are trying to do, and not just the organization, because we're just the formalized, organized part of a movement, of the LGBT movement. So we would like to make sure that the LGBT community at large in Norway is inclusive. And as an organization, we've tried to take some steps towards that, but I'm definitely not saying we're there yet. But one of the things we've been doing is to actively participate in the debate on refugees and asylum, actively participate in the debate on Islamophobia, and saying that that is similar to the sort of harsh words that we face in everyday life, and no such discriminatory speech or writing in the, should be tolerated. So by seeing that Islamophobia and homophobia are a part of the same kind of thing, and that we're fighting a fight that are similar, and trying to side with the other minorities, we're trying to be more inclusive, as opposed to going the other way around, saying that many Muslims have really strict views on LGBT issues and are against our rights, so therefore we are confronting the Muslim leaders, but we can't do that and only that. We have to also make sure that they see that we see where they're coming from, that they should not be excluded, neither in our community or in the Norwegian societies at large. Our main concern is that homosexuals and heterosexual, LGBT and heterosexual, cisgender, are treated equally. So we have our boundaries as to what we can enter into politically.
Mm-hmm.
I might, as a person, see that immigrants at large are treated badly, or that asylum seekers are treated badly, or something like that. But our job is to make sure that heterosexual, the general population, and LGBT are treated equal.
It wouldn't surprise me if the question of sexual orientation or gender identity is secondary to the government in relationship to refugees, since it is not the most pressing issue.
We have tried to push the government now to make sure that it's particularly been gay asylum seekers are getting the same kind of protection as any other asylum seeker on other grounds. And that is the fight we are fighting towards the authorities. And it's not a matter of whether it comes second or first or 10th place. It's a matter of seeing sexual orientation as a ground for asylum on an equal footing with political views or religious identity or ethnic identity.
Is that not the case here? Because Sweden, I know it falls under the humanitarian.
Well, in the papers, you would say, if you look at the law, if you look at all the documents, you would say that yes, it is recognized. But we see from the different decisions made on concrete cases of asylum seekers that your sexual identity is not recognized as a part of your identity in the same way as your religious identity. We see that authorities think that no, your sexual identity, you can just, it is just a matter of some acts, some sexual acts that you can just do anywhere or just abstain from. And once you do that, your sexual identity goes away. They tell people to get back into the closet, or not just back into, stay in the closet, be in the closet, 100%, 24 hours a day, all of their lives, That's what they're asking. And sending people back saying that if you do that, if you just don't tell us all, you can live a happy life.
Back in the country of origin, you mean?
Yes, 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 and sending people back. We have several examples, severe examples of that, where they're sending people back to Iraq, where we know that there is a manhunt going on for gay men. It's terrifying. So no, the Norwegian society does not recognize, the Norwegian foreign authorities do not recognize, or immigration authorities do not recognize sexual identity as an integrated part of your identity in the same way as the other grounds of asylum, which is terrible, because when you look at the rest of the society and authorities on all other sorts of issues, school, health, marriage laws, that is exactly what the Norwegian society has done. Accepted that sexual orientation is an integrated part of your identity, possibly one of the most deepestly embedded parts of your identity. And I was just presented with a good example. Just for a moment, for all heterosexuals to think how it would be to, at all times of the day, during every week, or every day, every week, throughout your whole life, always pretend to be gay. Towards your family, towards your friends, towards your workplace, everybody. Always pretend you're gay. Which would mean never to be able to marry, never to be able to have kids, never to be able to go out, never to be able to love.
Yeah, to live a full life in any way.
And that would, to me, be never to live a full life.
Mm.
And we're not asking for that for a period of time. We're asking for a lifetime commitment of hiding who you are, the innermost part of who you are.
And what is the tangible reality of asylum seekers and refugees in Norway? Not if they're sent back, but in Norway, do they face also issues of racism and discrimination based on ethnic origin? Or?
Sure. You have the you have sort of houses or camps where the refugees are placed at first, where they are often placed with people of their own kind or people of their own ethnicity or nationality, which of course to a gay person who's been running away from exactly that, from the whole culture, from everything, that is just a horror. So there's not a But they are trying, they say that they're trying to avoid that, but we do have examples of people escaping from these places, coming to Oslo and asking for Skeiv or Queer World to help them find a place they can live safely, because they don't trust Norwegian authorities, or where the Norwegian authorities have placed them, that it is safe.
That sounds like a very dark picture for me.
And we also have examples, we do have examples of people staying in one of those places who've been attacked, cornered in a dark place and attacked by someone from the same, what is it called? It's not a refugee camp, but it's a mottak, a place where Norwegian society receive people before they're resettled, probably.
Mm. Let me move on to something that you brought up in our introduction, which is the ethnic minorities in Norway, which I suppose they have full citizenship rights like any Norwegians. What is the situation of the LGBT community stemming from those ethnic minorities?
We have the Sami population, which have a separate, their own culture and also a separate religion, and from the rest of the population, and they have throughout the Norwegian history been discriminated against. So, which means that as Sami LGBT are another double discriminated group, which gives them obviously some extra challenges. At the same time, the culture, the Sami culture embeds a lot of homophobic views. So yes, and we've just had a new report on Sami LGBT, which just paints a rather bleak picture of how it is to grow up in a Sami culture, being LGBT. But one of the ways that we are not truly inclusive is that we don't have any material yet on Sami, which means that it's hard to find LGBT information in Sami, in their own language. Mm. We are trying to rectify that now, and I think before the year is over, we will have our first brochure in Sami, and we're hoping also to get funding to have some information on the web in Sami. We'll see how far we get.
Okay. I want to move on also to something that you started to talk about, which is the issue of HIV/AIDS. And not only to talk about it in the perspective of what you're doing at the moment, but if you could give me a little bit of a background on how the organization has dealt with the illness from the crisis on, and what's happening now.
Hmm. Well, the organizational structure of our work, once the funding started coming on HIV and men, sex with men, were identified as a risk group, LLH started getting funding to something that was called the health committee, and to our health committee, and the funding for different projects became bigger and bigger, and that became an entity in itself, the health committee. And last year we decided that that the health committee and LLH as such should split and be two different or separate entities. And the health committee is now doing health work and reaching out to LGBTs out there. And promoting safe sex, and we're trying to do the more political part of and the advocacy work to make sure that the Norwegian HIV policies include LGBT in a good way, and the T is often missed out, which is probably a big mistake, since I think they could be quite exposed, and another risk group, and but also for HIV LGBT persons, and to make sure that their rights are advocating for their rights. One of the things that we've been doing, I've been working against the paragraph in Norwegian law that criminalizes HIV positive people having sex, which is
having sex at all or consciously exposed, because I've heard about this consciously exposing someone else.
I mean, of course, it does not criminalize HIV positive from having sex, but it does put some put a responsibility on the HIV positive person to make sure at all times that they don't do anything to expose anyone else, and if they do, they are punishable with imprisonment. Of course they have a responsibility, but it is wrong to put a punishment on a sexual relation, especially when you put the punishment on the weaker part in that sexual relation. What we've been seeing is that they've removed the responsibility from the HIV negative person within the couple. Removed the responsibility completely, saying that just go have sex, do whatever you want, don't protect yourself, because the HIV positive people are supposed to protect you from themselves. So don't worry. And that is a big problem. Also because the HIV negative person might would usually be the weaker part in that relation. And worried, scared.
What is the debate around this at the moment? Is it something?
Well, it was discussed in the last session of Parliament, and they changed a tiny little bit. Now you can, as an HIV negative person, consent to having a sexual relation with some risks involved. If you are married.
If you are married to an HIV positive
yes.
person.
Then you can. And this is a very heteronorm way of seeing it. First of all, that a committed relationship can only be people who are married. That's one thing. And the other thing is that it is aimed at making sure that you don't, that HIV positive people can have children. Because earlier we have cases of people who've had children and used that to get their, usually former, spouse punished for having sex with them. Because they say, well, obviously we had sex with no protection. Look, we had children from that. And the HIV positive have been punished. Even though they've been very open about being HIV positive.
So I imagine this deepens the stigma against HIV out in the world, I suppose.
Sorry?
Out in the outside world. It deepens the stigma against HIV positive.
It does. It increases the stigma. It does. A HIV negative person can not say, it's okay. I hear you, you are HIV positive, it's okay, we can have sex without protection anyway. And if a HIV negative person says that, and they go ahead and have sex, it is the HIV positive person who is punishing.
Mm.
That's the case still today. No matter how much an HIV positive person says, I'm positive, I'm positive, I'm positive. It's not the HIV negative person will be punishable if he or she has sex with someone unprotected.
What is the treatment for HIV positive people here? Is it? I imagine it's part of the welfare state system.
Mm.
It's a free.
Mm. I don't know if it's free, but it's because it's very expensive treatment. So yes,
right.
It's at least. Subsidized to a very, very large extent.
I want to change a little bit the subject, and there's with some people that I've been talking about, especially some of the researchers, they expressed sometimes that there are some reservations to the way the organization has used what some people were calling a kind of narrative of tragedy and kind of exacerbating the negative aspects of the gay experience as opposed to something more hopeful with the aim of maybe finding money or finding sympathy, and saying that this is maybe a kind of, in a way, a kind of homonormative behavior.
Mm-hmm.
How do you respond to that? Is that
I
something?
I think it's a very important discussion that we need to have. I am not, I have to admit, I'm not ready to just throw away using the negative stories for several reasons. And the victimization, because that's what we do. When putting a focus on all the bad things that we experience during our lifetime, it's a sort of victimization, and I really understand, I really do understand that it's not always healthy to use that sort of a strategy. Definitely not. And I also understand that and agree with the scientists that it is accepting the heteronorm idea of heterosexuality being being the ideal that we cannot live up to, and we're sorry victims that should be taken care of. But I'm not completely convinced that we should throw this strategy overboard, and there are some reasons. First of all, because we are victims in some instances. We actually are. And I'm afraid that if we just stop saying that, that people will stop working on trying to make us equal. And my best example of that happening is my home country. I'm from Denmark, where you have no debate on equal opportunity between men and women, because there's a general idea that we have equal opportunity, so we don't have to discuss it. So we don't have to do anything actively to address that. And if we stop saying there are some problems out there, making us vulnerable, making us the victims in different settings, if we stop saying that, I think that we would also stop addressing it. So that's the one reason. The other reason is that it works. It works like hell. For getting funding, for getting focus on our issues, for making sure that school, everyone from all sorts of authorities, from priests to schools to politicians to different authorities, actually put our issues on the agenda. So it has some effect. But I'm not saying that it is not a discussion that we should have, and I'm not saying that we should use the victim strategy as without having a critical eye on what does that do to us as people and as a movement, as a community. Certainly, it's an important discussion. I'm just not so far ready completely to throw it overboard.
Mm. And in conversation with some of your critics, which I imagine is something you have, you engage in these dialogues. What do they suggest? I mean,
exactly, that is the problem.
There is what no suggestion?
I haven't, well, in school, we have a two-legged strategy, I'd say. And I like it. We have the strategy confronting gay bashing in school, bullying with, and we have to have that. We cannot just ignore that there is a big issue of bullying of LGBT in Norwegian schools. We can't ignore that. But focusing on that is the victim strategy. But we also have the other leg, making sure that LGBT issues are mainstreamed into the whole curriculum. Making sure that when they introduce families, that they introduce a diverse sort of family. When they talk about feelings that they and falling in love, stuff like that, that they do not just talk about guys falling in love with girls and the other way around, but that they expand on that and that they show the diverse reality that is out there, which is confronting heteronormativity in a different way. But we cannot do just one. I believe we have to do both at this point.
In that regard, I spoke to Ose Rotting, who was telling me that in the curriculums there's always the presupposition that it's better not to be gay, but if you are gay, it's okay. But it's really kind of
and she's underlined. Been doing brilliant work in trying to find other ways. She's one of the few other people who've tried to find other ways of expressing what we need without starting out with the we're victims.
I just have a couple more minutes of tape, and I want to ask you a question about the self-perception of the gay and lesbian movement in Norway in relationship to the world. Mm-hmm. How do you see yourselves as a kind of pioneer legislators? Or
I think there's a perception that we are very much in the forefront because we had the gay marriage and have other had the Marriage Act, which makes an gives us completely equal rights on that. But at the same time, I think there's an awareness that not everything is all right. Not everything is just fixed, and we don't have to talk about this anymore. I think there's probably... I hope that there's a view that we are at the forefront and have some sort of obligation to make sure that we help to push the agenda internationally.
As a leader of the organization, do you have contact with other leaders globally?
Yes.
And do you share the kind of knowledge that you've produced here elsewhere?
Yes, but not to the extent I would have wished to. We have not had the capacity to be involved in our global organization, the ILGA World, for a long time, and only marginally involved in ILGA Europe. We have opted for, in the international work, opted for some few development aid projects in Kenya and Nepal and the regions around that. But that's a matter of capacity. If we had endless capacity, yes, of course, we would. But I think we have just as much to learn about strategies, about concrete projects, about avoiding the victimization strategy, and all sorts of things from others as people would have from learning from us. I see that in many, many things, we are definitely not in the forefront.